Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the Ann Law Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Lowther, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The Ann Law Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another great episode of NucleCast. Of course, I'm your host, Adam Lowther. And today we have Dr. Tony Perung, who, you know, he's a senior leader in the field of data science, which is something we have not talked about on NucleCast ever before. And so, you know, Tony spent his career at PNNL, Pacific Northwest National Labs, and he led the data science effort. He was a deputy lab director. He's had a tremendous career. Just, you know, look at his bio on social media. And so we thought Tony's a perfect guy to talk about it because this is a topic, you know, we're talking about AI, its impact on, you know, nuclear command and control. We're talking about how we use data for all sorts of things now because it's, you know, it's a technology that is we're increasingly worried that some of the Chinese may have an advantage, and what does that mean? And so, I mean, Tony's the guy to talk to about this. So with that in mind, Tony, welcome to NucleCast.
Thank you very much, Adam. It's a pleasure to be here, especially to talk about an area that has fascinated me for decades and had definitely had a major impact on my career.
You know, what's interesting, though, is you know, today, you know, I've got teenage kids and I'm looking at, you know, what's a degree that they can get that will both be useful and will not be overtaken by AI? And so, you know, one of the things that's out there and it says, you know, it pays really well is data science. But you did not get a PhD in data science. You have an electrical engineering degree and then a PhD in physics, but you're sort of famous for being a data science guy. So can you maybe tell us, you know, what is data science? Because it's obviously developed over time. You know, whenever we were young, I don't remember, you know, and I'm in my 50s and I don't remember data science existing as a thing. So what is data science? How has it developed? And then maybe how is it becoming increasingly important in national security?
All right. Let's see. Let me start with what it is. So I prefer the term data science. There's many other terms you hear, especially if you go back over the decades. You hear terms such as big data, machine learning, artificial intelligence, large language models, data mining. I mean, the list goes on and on. There's a great many terms. I prefer the term data science because it is a little more general. I would call that it's a little more persistent. I think it's a term that is likely to remain valid, and it puts the emphasis on the science. I like that. A more precise definition I would use, it's about extracting knowledge and insight from data. That's really it. That's the thing you can remember. Maybe more from an applications point of view, it's about understanding how to solve problems that in a way that's data-centric. Now, AI has a different definition. It's a system that can perform tasks that normally require human intelligence. And AI has been greatly enabled by data science. It's not necessarily the same thing. A lot of these terms I threw out there are highly overlapping. As for the history and where it all came from, and you're absolutely right, nobody who's our age, my age, has a degree in data science per se. The history is very old. It's hard to say it started here. I would argue that even before computers, there were people worried about learning things from data, just as they were doing analytical calculations. Computers came along and accelerated all of that stuff, both sides. Neural nets, which is another one of the many terms you hear, they started in the 1960s. That's when the first neural nets were used and constructed in a way that would be familiar to us today. They obviously weren't at the scale we have today. Hardware, there's always been efforts to build central processing units and to make them faster and use more of them and do more number crunching. That's, I'll just call that lane one. But there's also been efforts to handle more data, to move it around faster, to reduce the latency of data movement. right? And that's where you lead not to CPUs, but to GPUs, graphical processing units. And those got a big boost from gaming, of all things. Mm. That's how they got to be, graphics and gaming. That's how those really came onto the scene. So just a little bit more of the history. I think that around 2010, there was an inflection point. A few things happened. First, I would argue strategically, three things came together. Massive data sets for the first time, impressive computing resources, and very complex neural models, right? Two of those three things would not have been enough. You needed all three. And so that led to the first deep learning algorithms that started to win contests. Starting in 2011, they blew away the image recognition benchmarks in the contests. In the span of 1 to 3 years, it went from nobody was using them to everybody was using them. Was really impressive. But again, AI, while it started to really accelerate and become more visible and have impact around 2010, it's not new. The Turing test was formulated in 1950, right? When I was a teenager in 1980, we were blown away by the Infocom games, the Zork, if anybody remembers those. Those were kind of artificial intelligence. But then the last thing in the history I'll tell here is in November of 22, probably everybody remembers this, ChatGPT was released and got 100 million users in the first 2 months. Since then, everybody knows what Moore's Law is. The number of transistors doubles every 2 years. There are new laws akin to Moore's Law that have been holding since 2010. And they are that about every, I think it's 12 months, there's a doubling of the number of parameters in the leading AI models. And every 6 months, there's a doubling in the amount of computing resources that are used to train AI models. So think about that. A doubling every 6 months for 15 years has been going on since 2010. So that's the history in a nutshell. That's where it all came from. Hopefully that gets you started.
So how about its role, kind of its increasing role in national security and, sort of more to the nuclear enterprise side of that?
Yeah, I'll try to tie into the nuclear enterprise here and there. But that's, it can be challenging. I'm gonna perhaps simplify and argue that they oversimplify just a bit for clarity and argue that there's sort of four main ways that data science has impacted security missions generally. And I believe these all mostly apply to the nuclear enterprise. The first is simply coping with the data tsunami that has been hitting us. Obviously, the amount of digitized data is growing at an exponential rate. The cost of a human, to put eyes on a sensor or a video camera, it's just absolutely infeasible given the low cost and the wide dispersal of sensors. So that's an example of a data tsunami problem. Cybersecurity represents a data tsunami problem. This is just oodles of data. You got to cope with it. So I think the first way that data science has really helped security missions broadly is to be able to cope with massive amounts of data. I saw this, a little quick personal story, in about 2010. I had just finished a multi-year effort to understand the genealogy of my own name, Perung. There's only 100 or so of us on the planet. I spent years trying to do this. And then they showed me a data science tool called, I think it was Inspire. And I took all the internet hits on the name Perung, piped them into Inspire, and in less than 5 minutes, I had basically recreated what took me years to do. It was astonishing. It just orchestrated and organized all that information beautifully. So that blew me away. The second way that it impacts security missions is simulation speed up. So number crunching simulations are, have long been a workhorse of science in general. And it turns out that data science, AI, can speed those up by orders of magnitude. This is a little bit counterintuitive to some. I remember being surprised when I first learned this about a decade or two ago. But the simulations provide the data to train the AI that essentially offloads a lot of the drudgery in the simulation to the AI. And you, in the end, kind of hybridize the process of doing the calculation. And it's an orders of magnitude speed up. That is a non-negligible advance that's come from data science and AI. I would note that the modern exascale computers that are famous within the DOE complex, Aurora, Frontier, right? If you go out and look at how those machines are being advertised and their actual capabilities, they're hybrid machines. They're being billed as leading AI machines, AI capable machines, and yet their purpose is to do scientific calculations. So that's an indicator of this second use, which is just speeding up computation generally. The third is, in many ways, I think the third and fourth are the most important to me personally. The third is what I'll call complex inference. So I'll come at it this way. Many of us will remember when, I think it was IBM and their leading computer beat the world chess champion. And some will remember when, I think it was DeepMind, a Google product, beat the world leading Go champion. Those events were 19 years apart, which is an eternity in computing. So why was it 19 years apart? Because to beat a chess champion, you can do a brute force computation. You know the state of the board. You know who's winning and who's losing. You have measures for that. And you just calculate all possible moves. And you decide the optimal one and off you go. That's what happened 19 years before beating the Go champion. Now, Go is much harder to compute. Much, much harder to compute all possible moves. And there is no reliable measure of the state of the board. Who's winning? Who's losing? There's no way to answer that question. So AI was able to beat the Go champion by essentially developing intuition, right? There was not a brute force computation there. And that is a profound difference. So the third thing is the ability to gain this intuition. The other example I'll cite, which is just unbelievably profound, is the AlphaFold success, which the developers won a Nobel Prize for that, I believe, very recently. So this is about the protein folding problem. How a protein folds, it's a long, long molecule, how it folds determines its biological function. We know the genetic code, so we know these molecular, the chemistry or the composition of these molecules, but we have to be able to predict how they're going to fold to know how they're going to function in biology. That was a problem that computationally is still, if you're going to brute force it, it is still a long, long way from feasibility. And yet Google, again, started blowing away the contests and the benchmarks. I wouldn't say they've completely solved the problem, but they made huge advances in protein folding with this AlphaFold AI-based code, which essentially is nothing more than artificial intelligence intuition. So the fourth way that I think national security missions have been impacted is a complete rethink of signatures. So a signature is an indicator of a threat or an activity, right? Did somebody set off a nuclear weapon? Look for radioactive material in the air, look for infrasound, et cetera, et cetera. Those are the classic traditional signatures, and those are still very valuable. But you can rethink signatures with the aid of data science generally. Let me give you some interesting examples. One of the things that rocked me in 2006 was a project called Argus that I find is surprisingly poorly known. So Argus in 2006 developed about 200 indicators of social disruption that have a tie to a biological event. And then they put web crawlers out there, crawled around, and were able to do biosurveillance in 175 countries. The biosurveillance that they accomplished was enormously successful. It saw things sooner. It characterized them better. In some interesting examples, they even saw governmental suppression of information about bio events, but they could still track the events. So they built essentially a worldwide biosurveillance system for something like $5 million. And that was in 2006, using just a few web crawlers. Another example I love is, so after 9/11, the nation and PNNL, and I had a role in this as well, we as a nation said we have to stop nuclear threats from entering the country. That's what we have to do. And so sensors were designed, sensors were put out there. You see them out there today. And there's an interesting story from the early days of those deployments. I call it the red pickup truck story. So there was a guy in a red pickup truck who would drive south every Tuesday afternoon at about 2 o'clock, carrying a load of medical isotopes from the Triumph Accelerator facility. And every Tuesday afternoon, he would get stopped. He had radioactive materials. He would get pulled aside into secondary and searched for hours. Eventually, he decided he would drive a couple hours out of his way to go to a different crossing that didn't yet have nuclear sensors. And that's when I thought, hold on, this is crazy, right? That there's so much information that you're leaving on the table, right? You're not considering the fact that you've seen this truck before, its manifest, its driver, its physical characteristics, the time of day, the location you're at, what's normal, what's abnormal. That they were asking the wrong question. Now, I believe this is changing today. This is, again, a story about history, about roughly 2005, when, you know, just the use of traditional nuclear signatures by themselves produces a useful system. But boy, if you can start to pull in all the information you have and use the tools of data science, you can react to threat intelligence in real time. You can sense anomalies. You know what's normal at this port. You know what's normal on a Tuesday. You know, if something went missing somewhere and you want to look specifically for that. Anyway, there's just all kinds of information that was being left on the table. I could give many more examples. There's some of the really interesting ones, obviously hard to describe, but data science has revolutionized the use of signatures. I like to think of it this way. The world has acquired a kind of transparency, and it's critical to ask yourself, how can I design signatures that don't just reveal the presence of a threat at a given location or the occurrence of an activity through traditional signatures, but how can I understand intent? How can I understand decisions? How can I move further to the left of boom and anticipate? How can I build a system that's scalable like Argus to global dimensions with minimal cost and effort? So you can just ask yourself a whole bunch of interesting questions. Which cargo containers should I search? Anyway, I'll shut up there, but it's just really revolutionized the signatures business.
So we're at that point in the show where we have to take a quick break. So we'll pause for that. But when we come back, I want to ask you, what are some of the biggest hindrances to the success of data science? So you're listening to NucleCast, and we'll be right back.
This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the Ann Law Deterrence Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence.
And we're talking to Tony Perrong. And, you know, he's kind of the data science guru from PNNL, career there. And Tony, so I posited a question to you before the break about the hindrances to successful use of data science. So can you maybe give us a sense of what those are?
Sure, that's a great question. I'd say 90% of the hindrance is the existence of useful data. Useful means you have sufficient data, appropriate quality, appropriate relevance, appropriate characterization. You don't have to have perfection in your data, but you've got to have data. And it's some interesting cases of both successes and failures that I'll illustrate with. I think I was once at a presentation where the argument was made that biology has reached the point, bioscience, where they could model an entire cell, just ab initio model it. The problem is the data resides on thousands of researchers' computers scattered, you know, scattered around the country or in, you know, publications, and there's just no way to bring it together as a coherent, curated, trustable data set, and so it can't be done. So the data there is an absolute limitation to progress in biology. Other problems you can have with your data, you know, it's an enormously labor-intensive thing sometimes to get your data right, but there can also be sensitivities in the data. HIPAA for in the area of medicine is an enormous, imagine what medicine could be. Not, we don't know, we don't want all our data shared. I'm not arguing we do, but just imagine what you could do if all data about human health could be shared and used by an AI algorithm. It's stunning to think what you could do. The census.
Can I ask a question about that? And this goes to sort of the broader point that you're making. And that is, you know, I was reading an article about the sources that ChatGPT relies on, to build its knowledge database. And the number one source was Reddit.
Yes, and, I've read that too.
And I assume that's that point is true, but I mean, I've never thought of Reddit as like the source of credible information, or even if let's say we fed it, peer-reviewed journal articles.
Well,
I mean,
I've seen subsets. I've seen AIs train on subsets of the data that the ChatGPT is trained on, where they restrict it to higher quality data sets, and that's a good thing to do. But you're right, the publicly available things are trained on essentially everything, which means they inherit our biases, they inherit our silliness, and they do make dramatic mistakes as a result from time to time.
So fix that if we were to do, to sort of address kind of the questions or the challenges that you're posing, and we wanted to have, the best fidelity we could, how would we sort of deal with all of those challenges?
Well, you've got to ask yourself, for your application, is it feasible to collect and curate a data set? Let me give you an example of a time I was blown away by getting that right. A couple quick examples. And that's sure. This is how you have to do it. The first is when the Department of Defense was interested in the problem of I'll call it rapid language acquisition. So suddenly there's a war in some far-flung part of the world. They speak a language nobody speaks in the Department of Defense. And you need AI can translate. That's not a problem, but you need to do it quickly. Well, how the heck are you going to do that? Well, what they learned to do was they crowdsourced. There are platforms, I don't understand that well, but you can go out and you can literally pay people, refugees in various cities around the world. You can pay them a dime or a quarter for each quality sentence they write in their language. And if they're, and for every language on earth, especially if there's a war near there, there's refugees. And so they basically paid refugees to write 100,000 sentences, and they could get that done in a matter of days for tens of thousands of dollars. And they developed ways of differentiating who was writing high quality sentences from who was writing low quality sentences. So they had a quality regime, and they cracked that problem. It had been kind of a grand challenge problem for a long time, and they cracked it with an innovative data acquisition strategy. That's my answer to your question. The other example I'll cite, I'm impressed with, there's a national effort, multi-agency effort called the Materials Genome Initiative, which is to use the power of AI to get better at predicting material properties and therefore discovering materials with more useful properties. That's a phenomenally useful thing to do. The problem was data, but they did it. They put the effort in to create a curated data set of material. I should have said performance before. You're interested in material performance. It's material properties that you know. And they created a database of 100,000 material property sets that was quality checked and curated. And once they did that, the AI started performing magnificently. So so that's the answer to your question, is you've just got to pay attention to your data from the start. One other point about data. It doesn't just inherit our biases and our silliness, to your point, but it can also struggle with rare events. So, for example, meteorologists have learned, they're very good. They've really acted with a sense of urgency, and they have learned to use AI. And there will be AI-driven weather forecasting. It'll be hybridized, I'm sure, but it's coming. It's inevitable if it isn't already happening. But one of the limitations is things like tornadoes and hailstorms and hurricanes, they don't happen very often. So there's not the data to train the AI on for the rare events, and the AI is going to be less good at those.
So, this is one of the points that a lot of people, I've written a number of articles advocating for, the inclusion of algorithms and AI into the elements of the NC3 system to do discrete functions. I'm not necessarily advocating Skynet, but I'm advocating there are lots of discrete functions, let's say, infrared signature recognition. And we've got lots of data on that. I mean, people have been shooting off rockets for, 40 years. So we sort of know what rocket IR signatures look like. But there is this, what I think is kind of a misnomer that we, and it goes back to what you just said, that we just don't, we've never had a nuclear war, so therefore we just don't have the data, and therefore AI can't be useful. But that's not really what we want to do. So when you have lots of data on discrete functions, you know, how can data science, it might not be able to tell you, you know, hey, you should launch six of these and four of those and put them here and put them there. And if you do this, that'll work and that'll end the war. It can't do that for you, but it can give you lots of fidelity about what's going on around you and help you make more informed decisions. Can you maybe talk about that some, how that can and can't work?
Yeah, I agree is the short answer. I heard an interesting description of how AI should be used, and I think it's relevant here, which is if there's any part of your life, if there's any part of your job or your responsibility or whatever you're trying to accomplish that you either don't want to do, you find boring, you find that's in the realm of drudgery. So I think the answer is offload anything you can. There will also be times to use AI, even if it's going to make mistakes, if it's, for example, really, really fast. Training AI models can be slow and hard, but once they're trained, they're lightning fast. So there can be times when that speed up can be valuable, and that's another way to use them. Back to the meteorologists, they use it for what's called nowcasting, back to this fast, right? So they could run their physics-based models, but that takes a day to run or whatever to give you a 10-day forecast. But if you see weather conditions evolving in this one county in Iowa and you want to know what's, you know, right now, what does that mean? Ask the AI, because that's the only answer you're going to get immediately.
Yeah, and I do wonder, like, even if something is not common, but has it happened enough that we have, you know, let's say tornadoes are, you know, once every 84 days. But if you've got, you know, 50 years of weather data, can you put once every 84 days over 50 years together to get enough fidelity to have, you know, something useful to say about tornado formation?
Yeah, absolutely. And like I said, I think that it's those rare events that are the last thing they'll turn over to the AI. But you're right. It's a way to go forward. And also remember, back to simulation speed up, you could just simulate a million tornadoes and feed that data into the AI to give it a sense, if you trust your simulation. So there's various ways forward.
And let me ask you, because we got to bring out Bob the Genie, but let me ask you sort of one more question. Where are we, the United States, in this data race compared to our adversaries?
I think we have tremendous advantages, but it's a foot race. I mean, we all know what some of our adversaries are quite capable of bringing tremendous resources and focus to problems like this. I worry about that. I mean, we have advantages, access to hardware, strong commercial innovation ecosystem. We have some advantages, but I worry. I do worry. The economic, I mean, it's not just a geopolitical strategic issue. You're absolutely right, but it's also, and you know, indirectly leads to the same place. It's an economic issue of the highest order. There's a reason that companies like Google and Apple are investing, and if you didn't know this, they are of the order $100 billion a year. They're investing in just the infrastructure to support their efforts in this area. And the reason is because their entire business depends on not being disrupted by these events.
So let me ask you about that, if I can reason by analogy. So my daughter's an elite soccer player. And when she's playing slow, I yell at her on the field, you know, unhitch the wagon, unhitch the wagon. Because I want her to, you know, play faster. So I'm telling her, get that wagon out from behind you and go fast. Does the U.S., do we have a wagon hitched to us, or are we running free?
Well, I hope I'm going to answer your question, but I think there's a really important point there, which is, I mean, our commercial ecosystem is moving very, very with all deliberate speed and purpose. But of course, that doesn't directly help U.S. government missions. And so one of the points I'm often finding I'm making is that we have to recognize the unfamiliarity of the innovation ecosystem here. A lot of us are used to doing research and development in areas where government matters more than it does here. $100 billion a year investments, you know, development cycle times measured in months. These are not things that the U.S. government is particularly good at.
Not at all.
And so, so the answer is partnerships. And I was impressed over and over again as to how feasible partnerships between national laboratories, universities, you know, our FFRDC ecosystem, but partnerships between that and you know, Google, Apple, and you name it, right? Those partnerships are actually more feasible than you might think. There is, in some quarters, there's still an interest in government money. There's absolutely an interest in what I'll call, you know, brand, making an elite brand, and doing things like beating Go champions is great for that. And the government tends to work on interesting, hard problems. And so, and finally, and something I should have said long ago in this discussion is, data science is nothing without collaboration with what I like to call domains. It might be the nuclear enterprise domain. It might be a biologist. Yeah. It might be whatever it is, but data science doesn't work by itself. It has to collaborate with the domains. And those companies that are developing all the modern data science, they have less interest. I can't unfortunately say no interest, but they have less interest in stewarding domain expertise. Yeah. And so we bring that to the table as well. But the bottom line is we have to partner. We have to get our government missions hitched. There's the wagon. We have to get them hitched to our strong engine, which is our commercial enterprise. And so that's my answer.
Yeah, that's a good one. Okay, so it's that time to bring out Bob the Genie. So as I bring out Bob the Genie and rub my magic lamp, Bob grants all guests three wishes, but they have to be related to the topics we've been discussing. So with that, Tony, what is your first wish?
Let's see. First wish is that I don't want to come across as negative, but I've had enough experiences in this field. I would like everyone to view this as a mission opportunity and not a threat, right? It is a threat if you view it as, gosh, I've been doing it this way for 30 years and I don't want to change, or I'm afraid my funding will change, or whatever your fear is. But you just got to view it as an opportunity. You've got to react to it in that fashion, because if you don't, somebody else will. And so that's number one. Yeah, view it as a mission opportunity, not a threat.
Yeah, that's a good one. I mean, that's a big deal right now, you know, and for, you know, folks my age and older, you know, the idea that everything we've always done is now being upended, that's a challenge to people. So, you know, it's going to take innovative folks who are like, okay, new challenge, new technology, you know, we'll do things better now. We've got wisdom and experience. Let's use this technology to amplify, you know, what that wisdom and experience can give us. Okay, so that's a good one. Okay, how about number two?
Act with a sense of urgency. I think all my wishes are going to relate to how we get data science hitched to government missions and optimize our outcomes. And the second thing is to act with a sense of urgency. I have seen failures in that area as well. Again, I've mentioned meteorology a few times. Well, I was very impressed. They're all over it, and it is a good thing, because Google and I think another major company have come out with weather forecasting AI systems that you can just use. They're just another service available to the public. So we need our meteorology, our official government, you know, meteorology, to be absolutely moving with all the same urgency. And they have been. They're doing a fantastic job, but I don't always see that. So yeah. Act with a sense of urgency.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah.
Because it is a race. I mean, it is a race, and somebody's going to win it. And either it'll be us or the Chinese or the Russians or somebody else, and they'll incorporate it and use it and gain advantage. And I always prefer it's us. So I'm with you there.
Absolutely. Third wish?
Final wish.
Well, I talked about how the ecosystem as a whole is unfamiliar and uncomfortable to some. I'll just focus as my third wish on one aspect of that we haven't talked about, and that's talent, human talent. Government laboratories, and it's critical that we get in the game of producing and stewarding talent in this area, and that is challenging.
What do you tell my kids who are 15 and 13 and they're community college students right now, and they're looking at where do they go, what do they get an electrical engineering degree like their grandfather? Do they get a PhD in international relations like their dad? What do they do? Or what's going to be overtaken, by artificial intelligence? Do they get, like right now, one of the career fields with the highest unemployment rate is computer scientist. And so my question then is as we look, 5 years, out, let's say my son, who's, he'll be 16 before long, what does he do? And he wants to work in STEM. He thought he wanted to be a nuclear engineer. What do I tell him, hey, this is what's not going to be overtaken, so as you look, years ahead and you say, we got to have the talent, what field do we want them to be in that 5 or 10 or 20 years from now, there's still sort of a valid use for that field?
That's a good question, Adam. And I don't know that I have a confident answer personally. I've heard lots of predictions and they don't all agree with each other. I think as a general rule, the more what you do can be proceduralized or possibly regarded as drudgery, to our earlier points. But on the other hand, there's a canard that it holds here, or it's relevant here, which is AI is not going to take, the only job AI will take is the person who didn't use AI, right?
Yeah.
It's that's the job they'll take. So, my plea for talent is we just need to get people educated on data science and AI and get them versed in those tools. As for how the market will play out, lawyers, doctors, engineers, scientists, I think, lots of boundaries are being erased, right? I've watched chemists be very uncomfortable at the intrusion of data science in their area. And that's part of my earlier, behind my earlier references, which is got to become comfortable with that. You got to regard it as an opportunity, not a threat. And you got to learn that yourself, because otherwise someone else will start doing your job. Answer your question, but it's a good one.
Yeah. It's one that it's developing, we're not quite to where we know the answer yet. So, okay. So as we kind of end the show, what is that point that you want our listeners who you've made them very nervous? And so now that we're near the end of the show, 6 months from now, a year from now, I mean, that's a forever time frame. But what do you want them to remember and to sort of, take away from this discussion?
I guess what I hope I've transmitted that might be a little more unusual. I mean, I'm sure lots of people have lots of exposure to the amazing thing that is AI today. But what I hope I've communicated is it actually has a long and distinguished history of impacting national security missions long before you'd heard of ChatGPT or deep machine learning. And, as a guy who spent 32 years working in a wide variety of missions, nuclear and otherwise, it just surprised me again and again and again. And it was, it's got a long history. That's what I'd hope people would remember.
All right. Tony Perrong, thanks for joining us on NucleCast.
Thank you. It was fun.
And thanks to you, the listeners, and we'll see you next time. So what a great discussion. Tony reminded me after we got off, hey, I'm not the world's greatest data scientist. I oversaw a bunch of data scientists. I was the leader of a bunch of data scientists, but, I'm a physicist by training. So I'll throw that out there. Tony being a good, modest guy, great discussion. I think hopefully you benefit from it. It's kind of a useful topic that we haven't really delved into much. So hopefully you enjoyed the podcast.
This has been a production of the Anwa Deterrence Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Grunthal. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NuclearCast.